From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Since September 11th, the United States has been fighting its war on terror, a war that's been called the great struggle of our time. But by many Muslim lights, an even bigger battle is being waged around the globe, and that is a fight for the soul of Islam itself. The fight between angry traditional fundamentalists and modern progressive Muslims. It's not really Islam versus the West, they say, but Islam versus itself. Tonight on Point, the battle inside Islam and the great internal struggle for the future of the Muslim faith. But first, we begin tonight in Washington with a big legal victory for Vice President Dick Cheney. A federal appeals court ruled that the vice president does not have to disclose details of how White House energy policy was shaped in the early days of President Bush's first term. The lawsuit was filed by the Sierra Club and watchdog group Judicial Watch. They charged that oil company executives that the vice president consulted were de facto members of his 2001 National Energy Policy Development Group and that their identities should be subject to disclosure. Today's unanimous 8-0 ruling by the court was a clear victory for the White House. For perspective, we turn to David Stout, Washington correspondent for the New York Times. David, thanks for being with us tonight.
Nice to be here.
So Vice President Cheney is cleared by the court here. He doesn't have to release the names. How did this become such a big bone of contention in the first place, David, and why?
Well, as you know, President Bush's energy policy is either a cynical giveaway to the energy companies or an imaginative way for America to become energy independent and still be environmentally sensitive, depending on your viewpoint. Those who find that Mr. Bush has, in effect, been trying to give away the forest and the land to the energy companies wanted the information on the formation of his energy policy to prove that it was not only shaped but indeed warped from the start by energy industry insiders.
And if the list of names had been made public, what was the Sierra Club, for example, suggesting the public would have seen there?
I think they were suggesting it would have seen a rather cynical giveaway to industry insiders, people who could profit from oil and gas exploration, perhaps even people like the eventually disgraced executives of Enron. We'll recall that President Bush was friendly with some top people at Enron before that company collapsed in scandal.
So they said these people were de facto members of the board and therefore the names ought to be disclosed. The federal appeals court today said no, and they said it unanimously. What did they find, David?
Right. The passage to me that was most understandable for lay people like ourselves, the court pointed out that it is common in Washington for aides to accompany senators and House members to committee hearings. And for that matter, it's common for aides to accompany executive branch officials to various hearings and meetings. Some of these aides are quite well known, indeed have considerable influence in shaping legislation or statements or whatever, but that emphatically does not make them members of the House or Senate committees or cabinet members, if you will, for that matter.
But aides in the Capitol are in a different category, or it would seem to be, from oil company executives, for example. Maybe the court found otherwise. Maybe they thought not.
Right. That's a good point. I think one telling thing was that none of the outside advisors were signatories to the final policy that developed for the Bush administration.
Clearly not. Dick Cheney doesn't want those names out there.
Sure. And I guess really, bottom line, the Cheney argument that confidential advice is absolutely necessary for a president and vice president, that was upheld.
And is the sense in Washington today, David, that this administration is more secretive about who and how it consults than others, or that this is simply defending the kind of privacy, the right to private conversations that presidents have always exercised, and vice presidents?
There's a little bit of both. There is a feeling among among some journalists who cover the White House that the White House has succeeded to an extent in marginalizing the news media, and I don't imagine, frankly, that a lot of Americans have much sympathy for reporters in that regard. But I'm not really sure that it's all that much more secret than other administrations. And it is a time-honored tradition, custom, practice, whatever, that presidents of both parties should be able to turn to people for confidential advice. It's worth noting, I think, that of the eight judges who ruled today, four were Republican appointees, four were Democratic appointees.
So thumbs up right across that spectrum for Vice President Cheney and the confidentiality of those energy industry executives who may have advised him. David, thanks very much for your insight tonight.
Well, thank you very much.
David Stout, Washington correspondent for The New York Times. He spoke with us from Washington. Since 9/11, much of Washington's focus has been on fighting terrorism. But there's been another global battle going on, this one inside Islam itself. It's a conflict between vastly different interpretations of Islam, of its roots, its future, and its relationship with the non-Islamic world. It's a profound battle between fundamentalist Islam and reform-minded Islam, says my guest tonight. This struggle has seized the entire Muslim world, he says, and now I'd say it's pulled the West in, too. Our guest tonight calls it a battle over Islamic reformation. Like the Christian Reformation, centuries ago, it's been bloody. It has spread beyond the borders of the Muslim world. It's not over. And it's not clear who will win, only that it matters a great deal. Tonight on Point, the battle inside Islam and the internal Islamic struggle that is unfolding as the U.S. fights its war on terror. You can join the conversation. What is the core conflict Islam is enmeshed in? Internal with itself or external with the West? And do you see a Reformation, counter-Reformation struggle inside Islam? If you do, who's winning? Join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Reza Aslan, fellow in religious studies at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He studied religion at Santa Clara University, Harvard, and the University of California. He's author of the new book, No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. Reza Aslan, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So here you are. I guess Iranian by family background. Am I right about that?
That's right, yes.
You are...
I was born in Iran, actually.
Born in Iran. And an accomplished writer, been through the fiction program at the University of Iowa. It's a wonderfully written book. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
A fairly young interpreter of a fairly old religion. Are you, you're 20-something now.
I'm actually 33.
Welcome to the big time there, the 30-something. and you've got people buzzing with this book. And we wanted to check in with you tonight. We'll hear from Fawaz Jerzes in this hour as well. But you come out with a pretty bold statement right out of the gates, and you say this is not a clash of civilizations. This is a battle between a kind of reformation effort and a counter-reformation effort within Islam. Make your case for us, Reza Aslan.
Yes, I think one of the main points that I make in the book is precisely as you say, that you know, while from our perspective we may see September 11th as having initiated some kind of clash of civilizations, to use Samuel Huntington's now ubiquitous terms, in reality what is taking place is a clash within Islam itself. And this is not a new phenomenon, I should say, Tom. This is something that has been taking place for a good century and a half, really since the time of colonialism. This is an era, of course, in which 90% of the Muslim world was living under colonial oppression. And it really was the first time in which Muslims were forced to confront the realities of a rapidly modernizing, I would say aggressively secularizing and even oppressively westernizing world. And that response, while of course, you know, really running the gambit as far as theo and political thought, could really be boiled down to two major ideas. The first was those that we call modernists or reformers who adopted these principles, these Enlightenment principles from the West, and really struggled to put them into indigenous terms to create, in essence, a sort of Islamic Enlightenment And then, of course, there were those who really could not separate the Enlightenment principles preached by the colonialists with the colonialist endeavor itself, which was, of course, a horrific experience for the vast majority of Muslims. And so instead rejected that enterprise altogether and instead reverted to what we could say the fundamentals of their faith in an attempt to Islamicize society. This conflict that has been taking place in Islam for a good century or so is now really coming, I think, to fruition in the modern Middle East, as there's this attempt now to define how Islam is going to move into modernity. How is Islam going to define the Islamic State? And particularly, what will be Islam's role in these burgeoning democracies? And I think that's why you see now at this point the battle becoming even more bloody and even more violent and, in essence, dragging the rest of the world, and particularly the United States, into this internal struggle.
There's a lot we want to ask you about that. We've just got 20 seconds before the break. At this point, as we talk tonight, who's winning? The reformers, the progressives, or the reactionary, the traditionalist, the fundamentalist Islamist? Who's winning?
The vast majority of Muslims in the world, the 1.2 billion Muslims, already accept these fundamental principles of democracy and reform. The problem, of course, is that they are not getting any attention. All the attention is getting focused upon these tiny groups of militants and extremists who are taking part in these savage displays of violence precisely to get the kind of attention.
But
that,
of course, it's been often seen in history that a smaller vanguard can wag the dog. We wonder what's going on there tonight. Reza Aslan, stand by. We're talking tonight about the battle inside Islam. You can join the conversation. What is the core conflict Islam is enmeshed in today? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the battle inside Islam, about the internal struggle that is unfolding at the same time that the United States fights its war on terror. My guest tonight, Reza Aslan. He's author of the new book, No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you see as the core conflict Islam is enmeshed in today? The conflict with itself or with the West? And have you seen the face of an Islam that could happily coexist with modernity, with democracy, with the United States? Do you see a Reformation, counter-Reformation struggle within Islam? And if you do, who's winning? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Reza Aslan, a lot of Americans, practically everyone at this point, vividly remembers 9/11 and the image of those towers coming down and the violence that was demonstrated right there. So when you say America, West, this isn't really about you. This is about Islam battling with itself. It's kind of hard to swallow. I mean,
yeah, I understand. I mean, it is important to recognize that the primary enemy of these fundamentalists, as we call them, these extremists, Al-Qaeda, these Wahhabists, are other Muslims. This is a puritanical group of Muslims whose primary goal is to rid Islam of what they see as its innovations, as its cultural innovations and religious innovations, and to return it to some kind of imaginary ideal of unadulterated Islam that, in fact, never really existed, that is in itself a historical fiction. Before September 11th, Tom, most of us who studied the region were very confidently predicting that this was the end of these groups, that the tide of reform was going to simply wash them away. And September 11th was really that sort of lashing out, the beast in the cage, in essence. I mean, whatever we want to say about Al-Qaeda, of course, as murderous and as savage as they are, they're not stupid. I mean, they were fully aware of the almost exaggerated response that the United States would be forced to conduct in response to this kind of attack on its soil. And we're, in fact, hoping for that exact kind of response as an opportunity to galvanize support for their cause, as an attempt to frame that as a war against Islam and against Muslim values. And unfortunately, at least at first, we really didn't do much to dispel that idea.
But we're listening, but given that blow, I think a lot of people are still going to wonder, if the U.S. really isn't in this conflict in a very significant way. But let me ask you to take us back a little bit. You write about two streams within Islam, broadly defined. You call them traditionalists and rationalists. Describe those two streams and the sort of their relative weight in Islam.
Well, this is a conflict that really started taking place within Islam right away, really from the time of the Prophet Muhammad's death, when Islam was first starting to be defined and interpreted. There were, of course, these two streams, those who believed that revelation alone was not enough to understand the faith and the religion, that reason and rationality was necessary in order to make sense of not just the faith, but also the scripture itself, that the scripture, while holy and revealed and divinely inspired, was nonetheless a product of 7th century Arabia and had to be understood as such. And then, of course, there were those traditionalists who thought that as a holy and revealed scripture, this was a revelation frozen in time, and that it has no historical context whatsoever, and what was written at that time is the eternal and literal truth. And if this sounds familiar to your
and
listeners,
it does.
It's because it is something that you see in all great religious traditions. There's nothing unique about Islam in its struggle between literalism and rationalism, or traditionalism and rationalism, modernism. It's something that we see in all faiths and all religions. In Islam, of course, really very early on, right around the 12th century or so, the traditionalists, because of various historical circumstances, really became the dominant school of thought within Islam. And outside of, say, Shiism, which is still a very rational faith, it is still traditionalism that holds sway within the traditional Sunni schools of law.
My skepticism begins to come in. I mean, you're saying since the 12th century, the rationalists have been out. You say the traditionalist position has had a stranglehold on Islamic teachings. That's a long time. And yet, on the other hand, you say, well, but there's a reformation underway, and it could go either way, and ultimately you're confident that it's going to go to the rationalists. We're looking at 8 centuries that say otherwise. Why should we share your optimism?
Well, because only over the past century or so, as I was saying, has there been a concerted effort by Muslims themselves to actually go to the texts themselves, to, in other words, inject their own reason and their own ideologies into the text and into the teachings, rather than simply getting that teaching from this long line, this 8-century-long tradition of ulema or Muslim scholars. If we go back to, for instance, Christian history, of course, that one of the major arguments in the Christian Reformation was who gets to define what Scripture means. That was really the primary argument in the Protestant Reform. And that's precisely what's happening here again. You're seeing not just Muslim minorities, but also women, ethnic minorities, rationalists, scholars, individuals saying that it is up to them now. It is up to them to decide what this faith and what this religion means, rather than being told what it means from these schools of traditionalism, which also, in essence, one of the things that you say, Tom, is very true. 8 centuries of stiltification, eight centuries of sort of rigid, archaic interpretation has really led to its failure, because Islam is, of course, a growing, evolving, adaptable religion like all great religions are. It is constantly in a state of evolution. And to try to hold on to some ancient ideology, some fixed ideology, is to really watch over its death.
So we'll look in a moment at this rationalist stream that you say is coming to the fore, that's pushing a kind of reformation within Islam. I want to ask you about what kind of democracy, what kind of society that might produce. But first, there's this basic issue, the basic question. For some perspective on that, if you'd stand by, Reza Aslan, I want to welcome into our conversation Fawaz Jerjes. He's professor of international affairs and Middle Eastern studies at Sarah Lawrence College. He's been with us many times, always sheds a lot of light, author of the forthcoming The Far Enemy, How and Why Jihad Went Global. Fawaz Jerjes, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure, Tom.
I don't know if you've had a chance to dip into Reza Aslan's book yet, Fawaz, but he's saying, look, the real battle here is not between Islam and the rest of the world. It's a battle inside Islam. It's an internal struggle. There's a kind of reformation underway and a counter-reformation. It's violent. It's bloody. And that is the more important struggle going on with regard to Islam right now. Do you agree, Fawaz Yurtiz?
Well, first of all, I would say really it's an excellent book, and it's really a pleasure to read, and I think it's very accessible, and Reza raises some very critical questions. I think there has been, Tom, a major struggle taking place in the Arab and Muslim world over the last three decades in particular, for the heart and soul of Islam and Muslims, no doubt about it. But I think there are more than one particular struggle taking place. I mean, in particular, over the last three decades, there are what I call three multiple wars taking place at the same time. Mm. Not really either or, a struggle for the heart and soul of Islam, or a struggle between Islam and the West. The first one, this is the struggle for the soul and heart of Islam. The second struggle is between what I call militant Islamists and the secular social and political order in the Arab and Muslim world. And that particular struggle lasted from the late 1970s until the late 1990s against what they called, jihadists called, the al-adu al-qarib, that is the near enemy.
Fawaz, if I may, what is the difference between the struggle for Islam's heart and soul, as you describe it, and this struggle that you describe between militant Islamists and secular leaders?
Well, there's a big difference, Tom. I mean, the struggle between militant Islamists and the secular social and political order was a military one. That is, basically, jihadis, what I call religious nationalists, launched an all-out war against the social and political order in Egypt and Algeria and Saudi Arabia.
So that's where the blood and steel come in, yeah.
Tens of thousands of people were killed, Tom, mm-hmm. as a result of this particular struggle. And I think it came to an end by the late 1990s. And the last one is the one between militant Islamists and globalist jihadists and what they call the Crusaders and Americans, that is, against the far enemy. Mm-hmm. They called al-adu al-ba'id. Mm-hmm. After religious nationalists, after militants were defeated on their home fronts, they basically took jihad global against the United States and the West, because they believed, for example, militant Islamists believed initially that by trying to defeat local regimes, they basically could expel Western, decadent Western influences mm-hmm. From the heart of the Muslim world, while globalist jihadists believed that local regimes are no more than they are agents, insignificant tools in the hands of the United States. And by expelling American influence from the heart of the Muslim world, you basically you can establish an authentic Muslim state or caliphate.
So let me ask you then, Fawaz Yurtiz, Reza Aslan posits that there's a kind of reformation effort underway within Islam. A, do you agree? And B, is it winning? Can it win? And I guess C, if it does, is that a face of Islam that can live harmoniously with the West, with the U.S.?
Well, Tom, as we have mentioned, there has been a struggle taking place in the Muslim world, at least, I would say, for the last three decades. In fact, some of our teachers would say this particular struggle has been taking place since the 19th century.
But that struggle that you describe sounds like a counter-reformation, not a reformation.
And you're absolutely correct. What has happened in the last three decades, Tom, is that what I call, reactionary forces have really dominated the social space, the social and religious and political space in the Muslim world itself. What we are seeing now, and I think Reza is absolutely correct, we're seeing that modern progressive liberal voices in the Muslim world are gaining their voice. Now we are seeing new social movements coming to the scene. And I think these social forces, these progressive voices, are finally putting their word, their ideas, their arguments on the table. But I would argue this is the beginning of a major prolonged struggle, and I don't think we know how will this struggle go, but it seems to me here that we can do a great deal by trying to lend a helping hand to the progressive and democratic voices in the Muslim world. And I think it would be very misleading to lump all Islamists, for example, moderate Islamists, moderate Muslims with the militant voices that we have heard so much about since 9/11.
Yes.
Because it seems to me, Tom, that the militant voices, the militant jihadis, in fact, they represent a rupture and discontinuity with the complex Muslim reality. In fact, many Muslim scholars in the Arab and Muslim world argue that Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri really have very little to do with the Muslim reality. In fact, they represent a rupture with the complex and nuanced and rich Muslim society and reality.
And yet they sure know how to grab the limelight and have done it in a bloody and very effective way. Reza Aslan, Fawaz Jerzy, there's a lot more we want to hear, but I want to bring our callers in as well, if I may. David is calling from Jacksonville, North Carolina. David, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, gentlemen?
Good.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. What's your mind?
First, I want to try to keep it short if I can. There's 2 points I want to touch on. The gentleman earlier mentioned the modernization in some of the governments like Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Particularly this past month, we've seen a few attacks in Egypt, in Cairo, targeting the tourism industry. First, if someone could elaborate, do you see a rise in extremist activity in Egypt against Mubarak, or is this just a criminal act coming from some of the poor in Egypt?
And David, I want to ask you, I see here that you were a soldier in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yes, sir. I spent time in Kabul, Afghanistan, and I actually dealt with some of the foreign fighters that were coming into the country, which is my second part.
Well, Reza Aslan, if I may ask you, David, when he characterizes the bulk of Islam, of Muslims, as moderate, how does that square with your experience as a soldier, which granted is an extraordinary experience?
Yes, sir. From what I understood in Afghanistan, because Afghanistan, as you know, in Iraq, two totally different demographics.
Mm-hmm.
The term that was coined to me in Afghanistan were the informed Afghans and the uninformed Afghans. The uninformed Afghans understood that the Taliban was definitely teaching against some of the teachings of Islam. For example, we knew that some of the Taliban leaders would send their daughters to Pakistan to get an education, yet they would preach that it was against the teaching of Islam for women to get an education in the country.
Mm.
So we saw a contradiction there. Most of the informed Afghans understood that, yes, there needs to be a renewed, doctrine being taught into the in the country. So we saw that on the informed side. The uninformed side hadn't really caught on yet, i.e., the Taliban, the Jaish al-Muslimin, all those other extremist organizations to try to keep the Taliban era alive. And that slowly but surely is dying away because we're seeing very few attacks from the Taliban, even from al-Qaeda, as you see with Abu Faraj al-Libi being apprehended this past week.
David, let me just ask you, as an American soldier, do you think it's wise or are you willing to sort of look toward the future and imagine that the United States can have a relationship with moderate Muslims in power, or are you afraid we're going to be confronted with the more violent phase?
I think we need to tap into the ability to the modern Muslims to say, you know, democracy is not such a bad thing. And I think from the military's perspective, we're seeing that democracy and Islam, and correct me if I'm wrong, they don't seem to mix. Democracy has never been a big thing. We didn't see a democracy kick up until the French Revolution.
David, you've given us a lot to chew on there, and we've got a break coming up. Let me take some of this to Reza Aslan, and thank you very much for your call. Reza, if we can go first to David's question, which is about the rise. He mentions Egypt and Saudi Arabia, but of course in recent years we've seen it all over the place in extremist violence, in what appears to be a turn toward extremism, even as you describe a sort of moderate reformation. How do you square those pictures?
Well, I wouldn't call it a turn towards extremism. Of course, there are these groups who are going to be taking part in these displays of violence and who are going to try to bring about their own particular social and political agendas, and will very likely do so by couching them in theological terms. It is, after all, the language of religion that holds most currency. I think for us, as Professor Jerzy so eloquently put it, it's important for us in the West to make sure that we give those voices of moderation and reform the opportunity to be heard. And this is particularly true with our allies in, for instance, Egypt. I mean, we have to be careful in the ways that we support some of these despots despots and dictators in the region, like in Pakistan and in Jordan and in Egypt. Because what is really taking place here, where you have these this lack of avenues of peaceful and legitimate opposition, you're getting to the point where that opposition finds that the only free space available to it is in the mosques. And it is in these mosques where it is becoming radicalized, where it is becoming Islamicized. So that's, I think, one important thing to bring up. I also would take offense with what David said. I think he brings up an excellent point, but the fact that somehow Islam and democracy are incompatible. I mean, I don't think that that's the case at all. There's nothing within Islam that is at all antithetical to democratic values. Quite the opposite.
Hold the thought, Reza Aslan. You've written interestingly on that point. Fawaz Jurjez, great to have you with us as well. Listeners, we're talking tonight about the battle inside Islam. You can join us tonight. How can the West best bolster moderate reforming Islam? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the battle inside Islam, the internal Muslim struggle that is unfolding at the same time that the United States fights its war on terror. My guests tonight, Reza Aslan, author of the new book, No God But God, and Fawaz Jurjez, professor of international affairs and Middle Eastern studies at Sarah Lawrence College, author of the forthcoming The Far Enemy, How and Why Jihad Went Global. You can join the conversation tonight. Have the war in Iraq and the war on terror brought a net gain or loss for Islamic moderates? What do you think? And Muslim listeners, do you feel free to speak up for moderate Islam inside the Islamic community? Or are you feeling radical these days? And then I guess, can the West, the United States, be a bystander here? Can it afford to stay out of this struggle? Isn't it in pretty deep already? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Sultan is calling from Salem, New Hampshire. Hi, New Hampshire. Sultan, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Well, thanks.
Dick, give me a minute. You know, I have a two-part question or comment.
Let's hear it.
I think what Fawad said is much more sense than simplifying what Reza is saying, you know, just isolating everything else. But Fawad made a very, very good point. It's all political and religious thing all mix up, you know, what is happening in Islam.
Yeah.
As far as the internal struggle goes, it's not any different than what's happening in Christianity, you know, Anglican Church, you know, on women's rights, on gay priesthood or women priesthood, and in abortion and all others.
Not any different, but those Christian groups, those are fierce conflicts, but they haven't really produced bloody conflicts.
Well, the thing is because they are living in a democratic society, so their expression is much more, you know, tempered and civilized than when you are living in a dictatorship all over. Yeah.
Still, isn't that a big difference between a kind of a peaceful hashing out of these things and an armed hashing out?
And even in this kind of a society where democracy and civil rights are there, people are killing doctors for, you know, abortions issue or in Ireland, a conflict between that or look at in Jewish faith, settlers are main problem for taking over the land and all that versus secular Jews and living in Israel.
No question, plenty of religious conflicts there. But let us pick this one up. Fawaz Jurjez, Sultan says, look, Islam's not so different from other religions. And yes, Christianity, for example, has some fault lines that are recognizably parallel in some way, and yet it's not armed. It's not in this century, you know, anyway, at the heart of any war.
You know, Tom, I think the caller's question is highly intelligent and highly historically nuanced. Mm. That the truth is, and as we know from history, that religion has always been used, has often been used as a vehicle for political action. Christians have used it, Muslims have used it, and now we are witnessing in this particular historical moment that some Muslims, a tiny minority, by the way, Tom, a tiny minority, which is very vocal and very violent, using religion as a vehicle for political action. And this is why I think what we need to really focus on is that focus on the multiple wars that are taking place in the Muslim world in order to understand the nature and the structure of this particular struggle. And what's happening now is that, again, that moderates, progressives are basically becoming a major force in the political world. And to come back to the question of democracy, I think, and this is why it seems to me, it's highly dangerous, it's highly volatile for the United States to become a factor in the cultural equation in the Arab and Muslim world. It's fine for the United States to exert pressure on Arab and Muslim autocrats in Egypt, in Algeria, in Pakistan, in Iran, but it's highly dangerous, Tom, here, for the United States to insist that somehow certain textbooks must be changed, because from the people I talk to, they're terrified, progressives in the Muslim world, they're terrified that by becoming a major factor in the Muslim equation, in fact, the United States would end up helping the reactionary voices and instead of really helping the progressive ones.
Until very recently, with what has gone on in Lebanon, the elections in Iraq, the major theme we were hearing, Fawaz, from you and from many others in the Middle East, was that that's exactly what was happening.
Absolutely. Tom, I mean, I'm glad, again, you asked this particular question. There is a dichotomy here. The first, point in the dichotomy is that it seems to me that democracy is not a technical good that can be exported like a car or a computer. You cannot impose democracy. It must grow roots within its own society. The point two is that, unfortunately, Arab and Muslim autocrats will not reform and liberalize and open up the political process without external pressure by the international community. And this is why I believe that the Lebanese-Syrian example is a brilliant one, because here the United States led the international community, including European states and Arab states, in order to exert pressure on Syria to pull out its forces from Lebanon. In this particular sense, Tom, the United States did not send its tank and armada to impose democracy in Lebanon. The United States led a genuine international coalition responding to the aspiration of Lebanese civil society, moderates, progressives, and Democrats. And this is why I think if you look at the Lebanese example so far, it's been truly fascinating to observe the underlying, the unfolding struggle that's taking place in Lebanon in contrast to the bloody and volatile and violent struggle that we are witnessing in Iraq on a daily basis, as you know.
Let me get another caller here, perhaps a question for Reza Aslan. Ayan is calling from Edison, New Jersey. Hi, Ayan. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Well, thanks.
All right. My question was, I guess, more of a statement. Reza mentioned earlier that, you know, to engage more with the people of, you know, for example, Pakistan and Egypt, because of the fact that they have no audience because they live under despots such as Musharraf or Hosni Mubarak or, you know, King Abdullah of Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
My point was that a lot of these dictatorships, as, you know, dictatorships as they're called, are the result of secular struggles, such as President Musharraf is, you know, a secular Muslim. Hosni Mubarak is a secular Muslim. King Abdullah is a secular Muslim. And the problem is not the extremism. It's, for example, if the problem is not that progressive Muslims are the solution to this type of you know, extremism. The problem is that America or, you know, any country is not engaging with the moderate population of Muslims.
I guess in part because it's the radical population that is engaged with the United States. But Ayan, let us pick it up. And Reza Aslan, if I may, I'd like to take it back to the question, the comment that was raised earlier about democracy and its possibility. I mean, for starters, you say it's not clear who's going to win this conflict, which leaves me wondering what posture the United States should adopt. And it's not even clear how it's going to turn out, because if it goes toward the extremists, we've got a big problem here, but let's say it goes to the moderates. What kind of democracy can we expect? You say that a secular democracy should not be expected in the Islamic world. Have I got you right on that?
And
would that mesh with you know, the sort of modern trend of the West of the U.S.?
Right. Well, when I talk about secularism, of course, I'm talking about an ideology of severing the religious from the public realm, which, of course, doesn't exist in a lot of democracies. The United States is not necessarily a secular democracy. We are a democracy very unapologetically founded upon a Judeo-Christian and more specifically a Protestant moral framework.
Well, all that being debated right now, isn't it?
All the time, exactly. And when moderates and progressives talk about Islamic democracy, what we are referring to is a democratic society. society, one that is founded upon the principles that make a democracy what it is, a freedom of speech and religion, pluralism, popular sovereignty, separation of powers, constitutionalism, rule of law, but one that is founded upon an Islamic moral framework. As Professor Jerjes very brilliantly just said, I mean, democracy cannot be imported. It must be reared from within. It must be founded upon indigenous values and traditions. It must be put into a language in which the populace can understand and recognize. And I think Sultan, by the way, I just want to go back to that point. He made a wonderful point about the fact, and I want to emphasize this, you know, I would say that the primary difference between legitimate religious opposition in the United States and legitimate religious opposition in, say, Egypt or in the rest of the Arab and Muslim world, and I'm not referring to these violent terrorist factions, is that in the United States, that certainly it's not a matter of aspirations. I mean, they both groups want to inject their societies with their religious values. But in the United States, we give them a voice. We give them the opportunity to present their argument and their ideas, and then it's up to us as a democratic society to reject them or accept them. In a great part of the Arab and Muslim world, that there is no opportunity, there is no freedom to express that kind of opinion. And so the unfortunate result is that it tends to become radicalized. And that's, I think, a large part of what we see. The UN Arab Human Rights Development Report that just was recently released called this a legitimacy of blackmail that is taking place in Egypt, in Jordan, where we are basically excusing these despotic regimes because they have convinced most of the world that if it weren't for them, the fundamentalists would take over.
Fawaz Jerjes, we've just got a bit of time left here. Reza Aslan asks us to accept, in a way, on faith. He says the Islamic Reformation can be slowed but cannot be reversed. And as I read that, yet we don't. He also says we don't know which way it's going to go. Is Reza Aslan a kind of pangloss here? Is he too optimistic? Can the United States share reasonably his confidence that it will ultimately be a kind of progressive, moderate Islam that prevails?
Well, Tom, I mean, it's not really up to us or up to the United States or the world. I mean, it's really what Muslims want, what Muslims would like to have. What are the dreams and the aspirations of Muslims? But I think Reza is on a major critical point here. It seems to me that in the last, in particular in the last 10 years or so, more and more progressive and moderate Muslims are making their voices heard. More and more, Tom, moderate Muslims are trying to Islamicize democracy and modernity. This is a very important to keep in mind. The reason why, Tom, is very important because it seems to me there's a great deal of suspicion in the Arab and Muslim world, the so-called Western secularized democracy, because they tend to associate democracy with colonialism and Western power and hegemony. And what Muslim moderates have been trying to do is to Islamicize democracy, that is, really to dress it or to wrap it with an Islamist, with a Muslim address, so that it would be acceptable to Muslims. And I think we should be highly, not only impressed, but also highly positive about this particular development. And again, all public polls, all surveys, all our studies show that, in fact, mainstream, moderate Islamists do not really represent more than 25%, even in Palestine, in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia. If elections were to take place in every Muslim country, including Turkey, a moderate Islamist would not gain more than 25%.
Well, we're listening. I'm afraid we're out of time at that point, but we're listening. Fawaz Jerjes at Sarah Lawrence College. Wonderful to have you. Reza Aslan, new book is No God But God. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Quite a
pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you.
In a moment, longtime White House correspondent Helen Thomas takes on the Bush administration. This is On Point. Helen Thomas, former dean of the White House Press Corps, received an honorary degree and more than a few boos during this weekend's commencement exercises at Northern Kentucky University. In her address to graduates, Thomas recalled some of the historical events that she covered as UPI's White House correspondent and exhorted the class of 2005 to be outraged at the Bush administration for some of its policies. On that, she hit audible resistance. All this month, we'll be bringing you excerpts from notable commencement speeches. Here is Helen Thomas speaking over the weekend at Northern Kentucky.
The 20th century was tragic in terms of human suffering, and yet remarkable in the strides made to learn more about the universe and to rectify many of our social wrongs. Racism, poverty, injustice, man's inhumanity to man. We had two world wars, Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf War, and now Iraq. It was a century marked by violence and the ultimate sacrifice by millions against tyranny. Ours not to reason why, ours but to do and die. But the last century also was outstanding for its breakthrough in civil rights, women's rights, human rights, robotics. We went to the moon, we're going to Mars. It is now for the educated, you, to protect our civil liberties against those who would play the fear card. Demand credibility and accountability from our leaders. Remember, they are your public servants. You pay them. Be outraged against atrocities committed against prisoners of war, deportations for dark-skinned people, detainees deprived of due process, secrecy in government that deprives the public of its right to know. Remember, we Americans are responsible for what is committed in our name, and right now we are held in the lowest esteem in the world. We have lost our halo. Question leaders who take the nation to war under false pretenses and rationalize their actions as spreading democracy. Democracy is great, but not when forced at gunpoint. Adlai Stevenson said, democracy is great, not just because the majority prevails, but because it's safe to be in the minority. Winston Churchill said, democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others that have been invented. As a reporter at the White House, I have had the great privilege of a front row seat at some of the most historic events of our times. I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis when President Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev, the leader of the Soviet Union, went to the brink. Both had the nuclear arsenals that could blow up the world, and both men knew war, and both believed in humanity. They were statesmen. Khrushchev pulled his missiles out of Cuba, allowing Kennedy to save face. Kennedy eventually pulled our missiles out of Turkey. A deal. It was Kennedy who said at his inaugural, never fear to negotiate, and never negotiate in fear. Would that our leaders today heed such advice.
Columnist and former UPI White House correspondent Helen Thomas speaking at the commencement exercises of Northern Kentucky University in Highland Heights, Kentucky. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.